Thank you all for being here. This is a historic event, one of many, we hope. My name is Sister Mary Jean Traeger, and I'm the pastoral facilitator from here at St. Cabrini's. And on behalf of all of our parishioners, I welcome you to this evening of prayer and conversation. Before we do anything else, please join me in turning down or off your cell phones so that we're not distracted by that during our time of prayer, especially. We've been planning this event for some time, and so it's so wonderful finally to be able to gather people together. And I have a feeling there might be a few more people drifting in, but we'll just make room for them as they come. So welcome to St. Cabrini's Church, and welcome to this event sponsored by Faith Coalition for the Common Good. This opening session on having sacred conversations on race. We're thankful that you are here, and we have had a little problem this evening with some of the speakers that were supposed to be part of the program, people coming from outside of Springfield to be part of this, and unfortunately, all three of them have had to cancel for illness, or for jury duty, or for other reasons. So it's just us, those who are the churches who are gathered. So we welcome we welcome Union Baptist, and we welcome Calvary Baptist, and we welcome the Abraham Lincoln Unitarian Universalist Church and St. Cabrini Church. And as they say often, whoever is supposed to be here, God has called together, and so we thank you for your gathering together at this time. I'm going to be the MC for this program, and I'm going to try to move things along, and so I'd like to introduce now Pastor Silas Johnson, who will talk to you a bit about the Faith Coalition for the Common Good. Pastor Johnson.
Good evening. My name is Silas Johnson, and I'm the pastor of Calvary Baptist Church and the president of the Springfield Area Faith Coalition for the Common Good, which we are part of the Gamaria of G of II, that's of the state of Illinois. We are part of the at-large Gamaria, which is about 17 statewide, and we are in this organization was formed about, we were discussing about nine years ago, and I was part of the founding group along with Sister Mary Jean, Shelly Heideman, and Pastor T. Ray McJunkin at that time, and the name was then formed for the purpose of the faith-based organization. At that time, we had we'd done what we call a listening campaign. We listened to what all the things the churches wanted to have and wanted to do, and what they wanted to talk about, what we would attack in our city and statewide. And from that listening campaign came a bunch of things, but there was four things that stood out. And we have added one since. One was the education task force for our young children, be an advocate for them, for our school board, to deal with the school board thing and the parents that could not speak up for themselves, that we would speak up for them. In that task force, they've changed some ideas, they've changed some handbooks and stuff like that, and we got a task force to attack that. Another one is the rail task force, which all of you have heard about the rail coming through Springfield, Illinois, the high-speed rail coming through Springfield, Illinois. We have been on task force with that. We have talked to the our first federal transportation secretary of LaHood at that time, to deal with both, and we wrote a community agreement that the federal government would not just come in and run over the people, but they would have an ombudsman person. That person is to talk to the individual and tell them what they can legitimately get for their home and for their property. And now we're dealing with one other thing with the rail task force, is that the dig, which they found when they were digging the rail and putting the rail in, they found a home there that was where the first 1908 race ride, they had foundation was there from those homes and stuff like that. So we're working with to get that part. The next part is city services task force, deal with all of the blighted houses and clean up the neighborhood and stuff like that in our city. Then the last two, one is civic service engagement. And then we're looking at now criminal justice, that everybody get equal rights, equal opportunity to do what they need to do. So we have these four task force, and we ask that you would join one of them, that your voice can be heard. And Faith Coalition is a organization of organization. And I must add, it is one of the most diverse organizations that I ever belonged to. That's why I continue to serve in Faith Coalition. Thank you.
We're here this evening because we care about the reality that is a blight in our society, the reality of racism. And we want to address it, we want to do something about it, and we know that many people have tried and many people have worked on it, and we continue to struggle with the reality being present among us. And so we're beginning this time of working together. The four churches, and we hope other churches will join us. And we're beginning this particular event with worship, with prayer, about, you know, gathering ourselves together for God's guidance as we address the issue of racism. And then that will be followed by conversation. We know those are just beginning steps, but they are very important steps. And so we will begin this evening then with the song, O Happy Day, which is on your chartreuse or yellow or whatever colored papers you have. And we're happy to have Barbara Little at the piano to lead us in this, along with some members of Calvary Baptist Church. And this is, as I understand it, is a kind of a call and response song. Many of you will know it, some may not, so we hope we all pick it up quickly. And then after that song, we will go directly into the prayer, which will be led by Reverend Martin Wolf from the Abraham Lincoln Unitarian Universalist Church. So we'll have the song and then the prayer, and he will lead you in that call and response.
Thank you. Please stand. Some prayers, of course, are sung. Others are through our actions. Here we have a short prayer that we will share together. Depending on your tradition, it is a call and response, or it is a responsive reading. I will share the regular typed lines, and you will share the ones that are in bold. So let us begin. God, you made each of us as a reflection of who you are in your image.
We gather in gratitude, showering blessings, surrounded by your many faces.
When the storm swirled, you brought forth earth, sky, seas, and life in all of its many forms.
We gather in creation.
When your people worked under Pharaoh, you sent leaders and moments of opportunity. You sent a pathway of freedom.
We gather as reluctant leaders, at best we only glimpse what you are making possible for your leading.
God, who creates new worlds and new possibilities, create in us now commitment to stay in the storm. Amen. Please be seated.
And now we will have a brief reflection that will prepare us or take us deeper into the prayer. And we're very grateful that Lorna Simon, one of our own group, is going to be leading us in that. We had invited someone from St. Louis who had jury duty and was not able to join us today. So we thank Lorna for leading us in this reflection. And after that reflection, we will continue the reflective mood by remaining seated and singing the song "As a Fire is Meant for Burning," which is on the other side of your papers. And we thank Jim Harris for playing that.
Thank you, sister. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
As you can see, I am not Pastor Mark Miller, but I'll do my best to accommodate you. I'm basically going to talk about an event or events that have happened in my life. Several years ago, probably around the 90s, I was walking by Feichen's school. Now, for those of you that are not from Springfield, Feichen's used to be a high school. Until they built Southeast. So it's, what type of school is it now?
Elementary.
I was walking by the school and I noticed that the kids were divided. They were playing in the playground. All the white kids were playing together and all the black kids were playing together. And my thought was, as you'll learn later, the desegregation issue had come about. And this was, as you know, we didn't put it in immediately. And this was a few years later. So it just struck me as odd because I thought there had been such a fight within the city of Springfield and these children were playing separately. So when I got involved with Sacred Conversations, this basically came back to me. The reason is that Sacred Conversations is you're going to discuss systemic racism. And you're actually going to, as a congregation, you're going to have a goal at the end. But in doing that, what you're going to see is things within yourself. You're going to see things that you've done, biases, systemic racism, you know, things that maybe weren't meant to be racist, but they actually resulted in being racist. Laws, things like that. So this brought me back to a time when I was in high school. And I want you to kind of think back when you were younger, and as the song goes, some of you have to go back farther. Some of us have to go back farther than others. So I give you a minute. So it brought me to when I was in high school. And I went to a Catholic school, all through school in Springfield. And I went to Ursuline Academy. And I'm not gonna say the year, but I went to Ursuline Academy. And when I went to Ursuline Academy, we had the largest minority population probably ever in a Catholic high school. Now keep in mind, there wasn't but about 60 to 70 students in the freshman class. But there was about 12 African Americans. So I'm sure we gave the Ursuline nuns a surprise. Most of them came from Sacred Heart School at that time and St. Pat's School, which the churches have now been joined to Catherine Drexel Parish. So when we went, we had a homeroom like 5 days into school. And so one of the nuns, her name was Sister Victorine, came up to us and said, "I want you sitting right in here to stay after we let the session, after we let everyone go." And so we're like, okay, because we hadn't been there long enough to do anything wrong. So it was fine. So she waited till everybody left, and then she came up to us, and she grabbed her cross, and she said, "I am so disappointed in you girls," because Ursuline was a girls' school at that time. And we're like, "Why?" She said that your nationality, your race, fought for so long to integrate. And here you all sat together. Well, some of the girls got mad. I didn't get mad because I was puzzled. Because I looked around and I thought, we are all black. You know, because it wasn't something that, as a young person, was the first thing on my mind. Okay, so this bothered me. So I went home to tell my father, because I was questioning it, because it just bothered me that she thought of us as black. And so, because he's an adult, before I could get it out, he didn't understand either. Because his response was, when I was trying to tell him what happened and tell him how I felt, his response was, "You tell her that we fought for the right to choose where we want to sit." Okay, well, that wasn't my issue. My issue was, I didn't see us as black. I saw us as coming from the same community. My cousin was in the class, the people I went to school at Sacred Heart, and we basically just sat together. It had nothing to do with race. And so then I reflected back to the kids that I saw playing in Fichten's yard. I'll bet the same thing. I'm sure it's probably changed because now they're all in the community together and they're probably starting to play together. But it was the same thing. So I think from that point on, the first thing I see when I see a person is their race. I don't judge it. I just see whether you're black or white. I'm very conscious of it. It's not bad, it's not good, it just is. That's what it is. So when we're dealing with our children, please keep that in mind. Our mindset is not like theirs. We teach them about racism. Thank you.
We have entitled this process Sacred Conversations on Race Plus Action. So I'd like to now invite Shelley Heidemann, who is the Executive Director of Faith Coalition for the Common Good, to come forward and tell us a little bit more about that process.
Good evening. Sacred Conversations on Race Plus Action came from our sister organization in St. Louis. The name of that organization is Metropolitan Congregations United. And this curriculum was developed following the events in Ferguson. And our sister organization, the leaders in that organization were on the front lines when all of this tension and turmoil unveiled in Ferguson. And so as faith communities, our organization, our sister organization, decided we needed to do something within a faith setting. And so they developed Sacred Conversations on Race Plus Action. And if you notice that it's more than just having a conversation about race, but there will be an action piece at the end. Oftentimes in our congregations, we look around and we just see people that look like us, right? We see the white churches with white folks, black churches with black folks, maybe Latinos with brown folks, you know? So we're not integrated within our faith traditions. But it's within those faith settings that hopefully we have a safe place where we can begin to talk about what our experiences have been around race. And that's how this curriculum is set up. It's set up to be within our own faith congregation, to be a safe place for us to begin the conversation about race. This event tonight was bringing our four churches together who are embarking on the journey together. So this is how we're kicking off the sacred conversations within our community. And then we will have two sessions that will be held in each congregation with congregant members. And then we'll wind up with our fourth session being, again, a united group like tonight. And then together we'll be deciding and looking at our community and figuring out what is the action piece that we need to look at. How can we as people of faith with similar values look at our community and try and decide what do we need to do as people of faith to address structural racism in our community? I want you to be aware that the definition that we're using for racism, it is at the bottom of your program, and that is racism equals race prejudice plus abuse of power. Race prejudice plus abuse of power. And so when we start these conversations, we're not talking about individuals being racist, which is usually the first red flags that go up. Oh my gosh, you're calling me a racist. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about experiences you've had around race, but then together as people of faith, how are we going to address the structural racism that's in our communities, even within our own faith congregations? So that's just a little bit of an overview of how we got to this place. And again, thank you for being here.
As Shelley implied there, a lot of people talk together about racism, but we are doing it specifically from the perspective of what is God calling us to do about this problem. And so I'd like to now invite another one of our Faith Coalition members forward. Marian Dion is a therapist in private practice, and she is going to talk to us further about systemic racism and what it means for us.
Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. I want to say, first of all, that I'm really excited to be here and a little bit concerned about the hearts of the people who have come out tonight and wondering about your receptivity to my story. This is my story. So it may be different than the accounts that you have and that you might share one day with others. These days, I do a lot of praying. I pray more than I ever have in the past, and it's something that keeps me strong. And I'm trusting tonight that God has answered one of those prayers that I've been praying for probably 10 years or more. About 8 years ago, I began to visualize myself meeting with my local congregation, the place where I worship, and just having conversations about who I am as a Black woman, and most especially who I am as a disciple of Christ. Instead, and many years ago, I met a gentleman that says when you talk to God, he gives you one of three answers, either yes, no, or I've got better. Instead, I have never had a conversation with my local congregation, and tonight I feel as though God has said to me, I've got better. He said, I've got better because I have you here to listen to my story. God has given you to me. I want to ask three questions for starters. What has God told you to proclaim? Will you proclaim it? And what will you allow that proclamation, or how will you allow that proclamation to change you from within? My answer to those questions is, first of all, to tell the truth from my perspective and my experiences. I will absolutely proclaim it. I'm a middle-aged woman, and I think that it's about time. How will I allow that change to change me? Well, I already have allowed it to change me because I'm no longer afraid of condemnation from man. My biggest concern is condemnation from my Heavenly Father. So tonight I want to tell you a little bit about my experiences with structural racism within the church, within the place that is supposed to be the safest place for me, God's house. I'll start by giving you a little background information about my upbringing, me as a teenager, college years, when I first came here, and before I came here, I started college in Chicago, and then Springfield at large. First, my upbringing. In my home, a conversation of race was totally devoid. We never talked about race. There was no Black, there was no white, there was no this group is better than that group. And I'm very blessed, I would say, to have had that experience. My schools were all Black, my elementary school and my high school, so my world was totally Black. The churches I attended were totally Black. However, I visited the South once a year, every year, where my grandmother lived and two of her sisters and a myriad of cousins and other relatives. And as a child playing, doing childlike things, I overheard from time to time conversations that I wasn't necessarily privy to about my uncles, my great uncles, who were abused by the local police, who would be stopped and have their money taken from them, the wages that they had earned for the week or for whatever period of time. I didn't know what to do with that information because I was a young person. I think the last time I heard stories like that, I was a young teenager. So I didn't have language to describe what I was hearing. And because I didn't know what to do with this information, I just stored it in the recesses of my mind. It just stayed buried for many years. Then I became a teenager, and I was just like the typical teenager. My brain was satiated with hormones, and so I did teenage things, and all those stories really got buried. They just were not an issue for me. Up to that point, I felt pretty good about myself. Being a Black person was, I don't even know that it was really discussed, except for the fact that during my elementary school years, during my high school years, and as a young adult, whenever I would study the history books, most of what I read about Black people was not good. And it really left me with an unsettled type of feeling. There were a few positive things, but not as much as I've learned today by taking action myself to just read about the history. So I ended up coming to Springfield, Illinois. But prior to coming to Springfield, Illinois, I took two classes my final two semesters in Chicago. They were both African-American history classes. And when my instructor found out the second semester, the last semester I was there, but the second semester I was in his class, he said, Springfield is a very racist place. I didn't know what to do with that information. I really don't think I ever had conversation about race before. So my knee-jerk response was to immediately to start to pray. And so I began to pray and I asked God to protect me. I didn't want to have to deal with that. It was too big for me. I didn't have language for it. I had never dealt with it. No one talked to me about it. So I just said, God, please keep that at bay. I don't want to have to deal with that. Well, the nice thing is that when I first got here, I ended up on Sangamon State University's campus. And it was the first real contextual situation that I had ever experienced with so many different cultures. It was such a blessing for me. And in that environment, we celebrated people's differences, you know, to meet people and to talk about the foods that they ate, to talk about the language that they used, to learn some of the language, to talk about the music and the arts that we were different because of our different, where we came from. It was all celebrated. It was such a wonderful experience, unlike what I had experienced for many years growing up in the church, no matter where I was. I reveled in it. I thrived in that environment. It was, it felt like a really safe place, a place where I could just be myself. I think what I saw there, and I don't see typically in our churches, is real relationships. I walk into a building with probably 2,500 people almost every Sunday, and we know people's names, but we don't know people's lives. You know, we know that somebody has died, but we don't really know what they were going through when they were alive. Then came the removal of the blinders. You know, God gives you what you need when you need it. And so, you know, he kept me safe for many years. In my mind, I was fine. And then he unveiled and he let me see the things that were painful. When I would go out into the community here, which wasn't much until I actually moved off campus and was finished with my studies, I had several experiences, three of which were like in my face, kind of racially charged events. One of which was not many years ago, a woman called me a very vulgar name. She screamed it from her car. And I had my son in the car with me, and I'm not sure if he even remembers. He may remember because he's heard me tell the story or talk about it. But because he was so young, I'm sure he didn't have language, and he probably filed that in the recesses of his mind. I like to believe that that event with that particular person was isolated. I began to pray immediately after that event, and I asked God for an opportunity to actually meet this woman, and God gave it to me 2 months later at a conference. And so when I saw her, and there were hundreds, literally hundreds of people at this conference, and she just happened to sit one table over from me. And I began to pray because I know who I represent. I don't represent myself, I represent Christ, who is much greater than me. I prayed for an opportunity to be able to speak with her. And on the last day, he gave me that opportunity. We were able to talk, and she said that she was a Christ follower. She was a Christian. And so I mentioned that story because I know we all mess up at times. We do things that do not represent our Heavenly Father well. And every year since then, because I go to this conference every year, I see her. We greet one another. It's a different experience. You know, Satan really is a liar, and we need to tell him that he is. We need to remind him that he is not in control, and we are not going to let him to continue to destroy the relationships that we can have with one another. So 10 years ago, my family and I decided to join a larger congregation for various reasons. That congregation is predominantly white, and we're still there. About 8 years ago, I felt God calling me to go and speak with the pastor. Now, I'm not very good at going through the chain of command. I guess I just don't, maybe I don't understand it, or maybe I don't appreciate it very well. So I went straight to the pastor, and one of the reasons why I went to the pastor is because I look at the church as the pastor's. This is the pastor's. He's the shepherd. He's the chief shepherd. It's his responsibility, and if he is not in the right place spiritually, then how are the other clergy or the other people, the other staff there, how can we expect them to do what is right? So I went to him and asked him, actually just presented myself as, like I said, a follower of Christ, and just wanted to talk to him about me partnering with anyone who wanted to ask me questions about what it's like to be Black, what it's like to be a Black woman. Now, I don't represent all Black people, and I don't know that I really have to say that, but I really had come to the realization that God had equipped me in such a way that I could I would not easily be offended, and that I could listen and I could give feedback that would be helpful. I want to read a scripture, or part of a scripture, because this is really big for me. And this is in Luke 12, verse 48, and this is an NIV version. And it says, "From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked." And so I think if we ask ourselves, what have we been given? There are times I have felt like Moses, I have felt like Jonah, and I probably have been in the equivalent of the belly of a whale. But I know it's because my Heavenly Father loves me and He has work for me to do. So I have waved the white flag and I'm willing to do the work that He wants me to do. So in having this conversation, which was very brief, with my pastor, he told me of another pastor in the community that I could talk to. You know, he's doing something, why don't you connect with him? I was really taken back by this response. I didn't really know what to expect. I try to go into situations today not having any real expectations, but just follow the will of my Father, which was, by the way, very unnerving for me. As a Black woman going to a church that, in my research, has never had a Black staff person as a part of, you know, the leadership, I didn't want to do it. So I really wanted God to pick somebody else. I wanted Him to choose someone else that might be listened to better than myself. And it was, you know, I didn't want to cause any trouble, make any waves. So He referred me to someone else. He also mentioned some other person in the congregation. And I don't even think I remember the person's name even after our conversation. Anyway, over the years, I can say that I still have not heard a sermon from a Black, even a guest speaker at our church, which really erodes, or could erode, how I see myself, how I feel about myself. Because I stay in the Word daily, constantly, I'm reminded of how God sees me. And that's how I want to always remember how to see myself, how to view myself. I've never known a Black leadership, or anyone in our leadership, to be hired that was Black or of color. It's not really told, this is Black and white, our issue here today, what we're really trying to work on, but it really is more diversity in lots of ways. But for the sake of tonight and what we're trying to do with this sacred conversation, I haven't seen any Blacks. I have never been invited into any conversations either about race. And that's how I began to offer myself to my congregation, just to say, if you have those, and not if, because we all do have those tough questions that we don't want to ask. We don't want to ask because we don't want to offend anyone. But I'm ready for it. I'm ready for you to ask me, you know, well, why is it that, fill in the blank, or, you know, why do you believe this way? Or why is it that Black people, and maybe I can give you some kind of answer, tend to think this way or view us this way? I was ready 8 years ago, and I can tell you that I fought that for years before that, but I was ready. What I have seen, however, which can be very difficult. I haven't seen it so much lately, but I have seen videos of whites in my congregation giving money to blacks or doing some other kind of charitable kind of thing for the black community. And that, I can tell you, is not enough. It really isn't the primary thing that black people need. It's not the primary thing that we need. What we need is relationships. We need to get to know one another. I don't just need to know your name. I don't just need to know that, you know, someone in your family has died. We need to get to know one another intimately. I asked a couple of questions of our leadership, you know, over the course of many years. And one of the questions was about the hiring practices. I wanted to know, well, how do you decide who to hire? You know, what kind of information goes out? And the response that was given to me is that we hire people that we know. I wasn't sure how to accept that. And I really, like, I don't want to judge, but I thought, man, if that person had just thought for one moment how that might have sounded to me, or it might sound to anyone else, would they say that again? We hire people that we know. Well, who do you know? The next question I asked, which was in an email form, and I was sitting there listening to a sermon. This was the January, I think, of 2015, and the whole year of 2014, the theme was everyone. We want to win everyone for Christ. So I sat there because you know how God is. Sometimes he does something to you, in you, in the moments, and you just have to react. So I sent an email to our pastor and said, where is everyone in the church staff? Here is the response I got. It's right where the pool of interested and qualified candidates require it to be. I'm not sure what interested and qualified means, but maybe we should look at it from God's perspective. Is interested or qualified only white? Or does that look like something other than white or plus, you know, something else? In conclusion, I just want to say that structural racism for me in the church has been really profound. I think about not just black people and how they are affected by looking at a all-white or predominantly white clergy or leadership. It works in the reverse too, but how does it affect my white brothers and sisters? And I have talked to my white brothers and sisters, one of which, when we were singing Oh Happy Day, I probably was pretty still over there, but that's me. That's me. But I have a black sister that has said to me, Marion, I wish they would play some better music because I just want to move my body. There are some differences, but we're so complementary. We could have so much more. Kind of reminds me of the university experience for me. When I first came here, all the diversity and all the celebration that was always going on because we appreciated and we loved one another. We loved to get to know one another. You know, we were in community. We were living together. We didn't just know one another's names. I think this structural racism within the church is more destructive than any other system that I can think of, because this should be the safest place, the most sacred place. It shouldn't be a place where I have to question whether or not the brother or sister sitting to the left of me or to the right of me really cares about me. But that is not where I find myself today. So again, I want to ask the same questions I asked earlier. What has God told you to proclaim? Will you proclaim it? How will you allow that proclamation to change you from within? And I want to read one more time that scripture, and this is the King James Version. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall be much required. And to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more. What is God asking you to do? I know what he has asked me to do, and I can tell you I have not wanted to do it, But I'm willing to do it today. I'm willing to sit down and have relationships with people about who I am. We are all created uniquely and beautifully and perfectly. So what are we going to do? May God give you strength to do the dismantling that needs to take place with structural racism. Thank you.
Thank you, Marian, for sharing so much of your own story and the context from which you come. Thank you. That whole issue of context is a lot of what we're going to be talking about. The next part of this presentation was meant to be given by someone who is an expert in history. Catherine Harris was to give this presentation, and she is ill and not able to do so. But she, as you may know, has just retired from the name of the library is escaping me right now, but the Presidential Library. But she has been there for a number of years, and she is a historian par excellence, but she is ill and not able to present her material, but she did send her material. So I'm just going to briefly summarize some of what she has said, because it's what we're going to be talking about next. We asked Catherine to bring the experience of racism down to our own local level, to Springfield. We've heard a lot about Ferguson. We've heard about all of the other places where police and people of color have clashed, where people have been killed because of their color, basically. And we know those stories, but we don't often know our own story. And it's very important. I'm a firm believer that where we come from shapes us. And whether we know it or not, we carry in our own blood, in our own system, we carry the reality of our history. And if we don't know that reality, then there's nothing we can do about it. But if we know the stories, then at least we can begin to heal one another and heal ourselves from the history that's ours. And so Catherine wrote about three major events in Springfield's history. The first of those is the Springfield's 1908 race riot. And that race riot, until recently, I knew nothing about that experience. But in 2008, we had the 100th anniversary of that experience, and we began to study about it. We gathered as people of the churches to ask for reconciliation, to seek reconciliation for that history. Again, if we don't know the history, we can't be reconciled. So we need to start with that. So in 1908, there was a riot in Springfield. And she says, many of you now may know the story of the 1908 race riot, but many may not know how this story came to be the forefront and how it came to be memorialized and commemorated with the markers and the monument in Union Square Park here in Springfield. The race riot was a dark spot, a blot in our city's history, especially since the event happened here in the land of Lincoln, in Mr. Lincoln's hometown. And she says there were two Isles Elementary School children who chose this topic for a school history project in the 1980s. And they wondered why this story had not been acknowledged or commemorated in our city's history. And so they went before the city council and asked that question. And their actions resulted in the erection of the markers that we see in the park now in the early 1990s. And so, what is the story of the 1908 race riot? It was rooted in a lie that was told by a white woman, Mabel Hallam, who claimed that she had been raped by a black man. The racial climate in 1908 Springfield was much like it was in other parts of the North. Whites and the many blacks who had migrated from the South following the end of the Civil War were jockeying for jobs, and Springfield was no different. Many whites felt that the Negroes, as they were called then, had made progress and were getting too uppity, as many owned businesses and shops in the area near downtown called the Levee and Badlands, the site where Horace Mann Insurance Company stands today. The cry of rape on a hot summer day and the ensuing violence and destruction left William Donegan, an elderly black man who had once made boots for Abe Lincoln, hanging with his throat slit and his body mutilated in a tree near Spring and Edwards Street. And when we think about Springfield and we know where these places are, it brings it back home to us. It mattered not that Donegan had been married for many years to his wife, a white woman. He was hanged. Scott Burton, a successful barber, was hanged near 12th and Madison Streets. We drive past those streets often today. A white man, Harry Loper, saw his restaurant burned by the out-of-control mob. When the dust settled and the destruction ended, hundreds of dollars of damage and many injuries had resulted, all because of the lie. Eventually, Mabel Hallam recanted the lie, but the damage was done. And we carry that in our history, whether we know the story or not. One positive thing came out of that story. As a result of those fateful nights in August 1908, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, the oldest and most beloved and most reviled civil rights organization in the nation, was founded in the following year because of the race riot. This event in Springfield made national history, and the work of the NAACP continues today. So that's one of the events, and keep this in mind because we're going to be talking about this when we have our conversations. The next event that she named was the 1974 court case to end discrimination in our city schools. 1974 was the court case to end discrimination in our city schools in Springfield. The court case Nagel McPherson et al. Versus Springfield District 186. This case aimed to eliminate the racial inequality in education in our city, including discriminatory policies such as tracking, teacher assignments, lack of minority teachers and administrators, etc. The consent decree, as it was called, that resulted from this case required that the district not only acknowledge these issues, but address these inequities and work to annually report on the progress made or not in recruiting, hiring, assignments, retention, salaries, student transfer rates, minority-majority ratios and levels, and other related concerns. Although progress has been made as a result of this decree, the district is still to this day not in full compliance, and work still needs to be done to address these issues. And then the third issue, perhaps the most significant event in racial history in our city, is the change in the form of government. change and struggle go hand in hand. McNeil versus the City of Springfield brought much needed change to how our city is governed. In the years between 1911 and 1933, Springfield did have an aldermanic form of government, much as today with wards and a city council. That was, however, replaced with the commission form of government, which left the east side, predominantly and historically the black part of Springfield, with no representation or voice in city government matters. At the time of the lawsuit, Springfield was the only Illinois city with the commission form of government for a city of comparable size in the nation. The lawsuit challenged the legality of this form of government under the Federal Voting Rights Act. The settlement of the suit brought the first true representation of government for all of Springfield's residents. The initial city council was inaugurated on December 1st, 1987. And the members, now I did not name the members of the commission form of government, but you should know these. Before the lawsuit, Mayor Michael Houston, Finance Commissioner Tom Pape, Public Health and Safety Commissioner Pat Ward, Streets and Public Improvement Commissioner Ozzie Langfelder, and Public Property Commissioner Paul Bonansinga. All white people. And that's what happened over and over and over again in the commission form of government. After the lawsuit in December 1st, 1987, this was the city council. Mayor Ozzie Langfelder, Ward 1, Bill Clutter, Ward 2, Frank McNeil, an African American, Ward 3, Phil Burnett, Ward 4, Chuck Redpath, Ward 5, Bob Vose, Ward 6, Jack Andrews, Ward 7, Barry Becker, Ward 8, Irv Smith, Ward 9, Nick Busson, and Ward 10, Alan Woodson. I believe two African Americans in that list. This change was a major step forward in improving race relations in Springfield. For now, the voice of the people, especially those on the east side, could be heard. Despite changes in boundaries for both schools and wards, these two changes have been genuine attempts to make Springfield a better place for all its residents. We want to keep in mind those three events then, the race riot, the lawsuit, demanding the change in city government, and the lawsuit demanding the changes in the school district, because those are issues that we're going to be talking about soon. So that is a very brief summary of Catherine's talk. And we're very grateful that she was able at least to send that summary.